Switching gears a bit now and talking with you about wildlife art, American wildlife art, and a couple of guests for you. David Wagner, I'm really pleased to have David back. He's from Milwaukee, National Authority on Wildlife Art. He's been a museum director, curator, author of the book, American Wildlife Art. I have it in front of me. It's a over 400-page volume with 310 beautiful color illustrations. It's published by Marquand Books of Seattle, Washington. Really, David, good to have you back.
Oh, it's an honor to be back, Larry. I'm a regular listener of your show, and to be asked back is a real honor. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being here today with me in the studio. With us by phone today is Kent Ahlberg of Loveland, Colorado, and Padre Island, Corpus Christi, Texas. Kent is considered the number one living wildlife sculptors in the world, the number one living sculptor in the world. He has at least 80 monumental wildlife installations on four continents, wrote the introduction to David's book, and is featured on 16 pages of the book, American Wildlife Art. So really pleased to have Ken. Are you with us?
I am here indeed, Larry.
Oh, thank you so much for being with us as well. I should mention that David was also former director of the Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum here in Wisconsin, and he serves as curator and tour director for the prestigious Society of Animal Artists. That's a worldwide organization. And gosh, I'm really pleased to have you both with us. You may have some questions about wildlife art as we move along here today, and I hope you do, and I hope you'll join us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And David has a lecture and slideshow coming up on Thursday as well, so we're going to mention that too. But first, let's just talk about wildlife art, and I want your reaction from both of you. David, first, maybe from you. What is wildlife art, and how does it differ from other art?
Well, wildlife art is comprised of a variety of media, paintings, sculpture, wood carvings, prints, and so forth. And the subject of these artistic sort of manifestations is generally wild animals that inhabit North America, or at least that's the focus of my book. Of course, wildlife art has been practiced and produced worldwide. I know early on in Kent's career, he worked in Africa, for example, but the focus of my book is American by nature, so the theme of the paintings and sculptures has to do with American wildlife species.
Yeah. And Kent, maybe you could talk a little a bit about it, too. I'd like to know how you came to be in the profession that you're in, and how you came to love this art.
Well, Larry, I grew up in Sweden, actually. I grew up in a little fishing village on the North Sea, and my family were seafarers, and so I grew up in closeness to nature, and so it's always been part of my world. And when I was becoming an artist and went to art school in Stockholm, it was a culture shock for me. I ended up in art school in the 60s, you know, and not only were you not supposed to sculpt or paint wildlife, but not even recognizable subjects. You know, you were supposed to do non-objective art, especially in a backwater like Sweden. We were supposed to be in New York in the 60s, so I had a bit of an sort of an uphill swim there, you know, for quite a long time. And I had a very, very kind professor, and he was so concerned about me, you know. He said to me, "Kent, you never make a living with wildlife art. You can't sculpt animals. It's been done, you know." And, but, you know, I'm a proof, living proof, that if you live long enough, the art world always changes. And it is now swung around to representation, like Dave talks about in the last chapter of his book with postmodernism. And I finally have found a forum where I can talk about my passion, which is nature. But it's a long path, Larry. It's gone via Africa, like Dave said, and now in the U.S.
Well, that's a great story. And, you know, for those who are not familiar with your work and your sculpturing, what are some things that you love to do?
Mostly public sculptures, actually. Lately, I've been commissioned to do a lot of very large works, and they are a bit all over, a lot in America, of course, at the National Wildlife Federation in Washington, D.C. You know, I have a very large sculpture, about 14-foot sculpture of cranes in stainless steel, and I have a sculpture of fish in Cape Town, South Africa, and I have several large wildlife subject sculptures in Sweden and in Luxembourg, but mostly in the U.S., and it's been my passion to really celebrate nature, and if you do it with public sculpture, very large sculptures, you know, you get a big voice to speak about what you really care about. You know, people can't really ignore them when they drive to work unless they close their eyes, you know.
And, you know, maybe, David, you could comment on Kent's work a little bit.
Well, I'm just sort of leafing through the book here, Kent, American Wildlife Art, and your chapter, and I wanted to show Larry the real tour de force entitled Sailfish in Three Stages of Ascending. This is at the Fort Lauderdale Visitors and Convention Center, where a lot of the great cruise ships take off. And it was unveiled in 1991, if I'm not mistaken, a decade after Kent had, I think, his first major public sculpture commission, the Dallas Lincoln Center Eagle. And between 1981 and 91, Ulberg went from being inspired by Philip Johnson and hearing a lecture at the National Sculpture Society in New York City on postmodernism, where Johnson was given the highest award in the field, to Ulberg himself being given the same award one decade later, when this sculpture, I'm not sure how you unveil something that large. If it was,
it was a
city block with a plinth of granite and fountain and water effects as sort of an it's a very rich sculpture, actually, and in many respects it's very layered and is interesting not only visually and ecologically but also philosophically as an homage, I think, to one of Kent's early pioneers in pop art in this country. Kent, you might want to pick it up from there.
Well, thank you, Dave. As you can hear, Dave is a dear friend of mine. We've been friends for a long, long time. We've been all over the world together in shows and art, and you're very kind to me, Dave. But yes, indeed, it is a Swedish sculptor, you know, who became very, very famous in the U.S. And when I was in art school, pop art was finally the thing that sort of broke a little bit the formality of you know, the non-objective art and stuff. So we thought it was fun, you know. And he did a lot of funny things, including a sculpture in California, which was very controversial, called a cowboy hat in three stages of landing. So when I was commissioned to do this huge sculpture, I came up with the idea of analyzing a sailfish in three stages of ascending. And, of course, the sculptor's name is Claes Oldenburg. He was born in Sweden and become one of the biggest icons in the world, really, in the pop art field. And he's still around, still working, too.
Well, it's a beautiful story. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. By the way, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Karen in Green Bay is online. So let's go to Karen. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, we inherited two watercolors, quite large pictures, and they're of Geese Landing is the name of one, but we can't find any information about the artist, and we're trying to find out if we should get these insured or what we should do with these paintings. And the artist it's really hard to see. The first name starts with an A, and it's Boyce, like Marin, M-A-R-Y-N, something like that. I don't know if anyone's heard of that artist.
I don't. The name doesn't come to mind, though. There are so many, many artists who work in wildlife art. I suppose you could check back issues of Wildlife Art magazine. That might be one good place to start, because they do have an artist's registry, though the magazine was recently stopped because of the they were having economic difficulties. But in any event, that might be one good place for you to start, and you might check at the Green Bay Public Library for back issues.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And boy, this the book. I tell you, I asked Kent how he became interested in his profession. How did you become interested in this field?
Well, I became interested just out of, I guess, a lucky alignment of the stars, you might say. When I was about to graduate with my master's degree in museum management and arts administration, I was eager to find a good job, and I was lucky enough at age 23 to interview for a position as director of the Lee Yawkey Woods and Art Museum in Wausau, Wisconsin. And I was invited to come up and interview for the position at Wausau Insurance Companies. I remember one of the board members was president at the time, and that led to the job being offered to me, and with that, I was thrown into the center of the wildlife art world through the exhibition Birds in Art.
And we'll talk some more with both of our guests, David Wagner and Ken Ulberg, in just a minute here on the Ideas Net. Talking about American wildlife art here on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guest, David Wagner of Milwaukee, National Authority on Wildlife Art and author of the book American Wildlife Art. Beautiful book published by Marquand Books of Seattle, Washington. And also visiting today by phone with Ken Ulberg of Loveland, Colorado, who is considered the number one living wildlife sculptor in the world. So really pleased to have both of them with us, and invite you to join in with your questions. I know we'll get to Josh and Hayward in just a minute here, who's online. You can join us, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And, David, before we go any further, I've got some questions for Kent, too, but tell us about the book. You know, it was from your PhD dissertation, right?
It grew out of my dissertation. I wrote my dissertation at the University of Minnesota, and its title was Signed Limited Edition Wildlife Art Prints. And back when I wrote it in the late 80s, I wanted to understand how a piece of paper, which might have cost, say, $4 or $5 to print on a printing press, a mass printing press through offset lithography, could be marketed by signing it and numbering it as a limited edition and turned around and sold for $200 or $300. How you could accomplish that feat from going to a commodity of $4 for production cost to $200 to $300 in sales. And so I spent years doing research and actually wrote the dissertation and completed it. And after that, Roger Torrey Peterson, the famous ornithologist who was a good friend of Kent's and mine, he invited me to organize a major symposium at Chautauqua near his hometown in Jamestown, and at that symposium was an editor for Cornell University Press, and she was impressed with the topic and the themes, etc., and inquired if I might want to expand this dissertation to include sculpture and painting, etc., and publish it. And I said, by all means. So I spent the next decade of my life expanding my dissertation, and ultimately it was transferred to Marquand Books, which specializes in large coffee table books, really deluxe, beautiful design books.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And they ultimately published it, and it was released last Valentine's Day in Charleston, South Carolina.
And it's done pretty well.
It's done real well. It's been steady, and we've been worried with the economy and all, but there's been a steady, regular interest, and people have been buying it. And the comments that I've received online at Amazon, or some are posted on the book's websites, American-Wildlife-Art.com, have been very gratifying, and I've been delighted with the results from the book.
Well, Larry? Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to add something. You know, I definitely think the book is magnificent, but also there is nobody in the whole world better qualified to write this book than Dave, you know. And he mentioned, for example, the Liaki Woodson's Birds in Art. Well, he very modestly, you know, didn't mention how important that show was that Dave organized and curated and everything. He traveled around the world. He went to Stockholm. I've been with Dave in China. One of the early, very early Western shows that went to China was organized by Birds in Art by Dave. And so not only is he a scholar, but he also has experience on the ground, so to speak. You know, he's got dirty hands with art as well.
Right.
You know.
It's wonderful. We've got Josh from Hayward online, I believe, has a question that is aimed at you. Josh, are you there?
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
You never know when you get to talk to one of your heroes on this show. I've been in the sculpting and carving business most of my life. My grandmother and my mother both were sculptors, and I kind of learned all of this on my own, and I've won some awards. In the last 10 years, I've been doing dental work to kind of feed my habit. But what I'm wondering, I would like to graduate to doing bronze work. And is there such a thing as a manager or something that you can hire to show your work, you know, somebody that would represent you? You know, like if you were a writer, you would have someone to represent you. Is there such a thing in the sculpture business, or is it kind of just go out and beat the doors yourself, or...
Okay.
Josh, that niche is normally filled by dealers, by galleries, you know, by art galleries. Are you exhibiting in a gallery right now?
Well, I have on and off. What I'm wondering about with the bronze is it's an expensive proposition, you know, to produce a piece. And what I'm thinking is that if I complete some originals in wax and then take them around or have somebody show them, before, you know, and find someone that's willing to invest in the sculpture and produce them, you know, that way, rather than trying to find, you know, the money and the time to make a casting that somebody may or may not want.
Yeah, you know, Josh really has addressed something here that is kind of interesting, the sculpture, the bronze part, the casting, which is very, very difficult. You know, you're a painter, you finish your painting, you have a marketable product. You know, you can hang it on the wall or sell it, but as a sculptor, like Josh said, you have a blob of wax, you know, that looks like an animal or clay, you know, and the translation to bronze is very costly, and it's very difficult for all of us. The way I did it, I scraped together money and cast one piece and then exhibited it and managed to sell it and got enough money to do two pieces and so on, but there are examples out there of patrons that would be willing sometimes to finance, you know, castings and stuff. And but it's hard to find, Josh, you know, and sometimes the galleries, you should try to find a decent gallery that would that believe in you, and they could sometimes, they would front you the money to do a casting after you've shown them the original wax or clay. That's what I recommend, you know.
Yeah. David, any comment from you?
Well, I would add to that you should seek out exhibition opportunities to whatever degree you can. Kent is a member of the National Sculpture Society. He's a member of the National Academy of Design in New York City on Fifth Avenue. He's a member of the Society of Animal Artists in New York, and he exhibits in lots of museum exhibitions. As a matter of fact, I was fortunate enough to serve as curator and tour director for a major traveling exhibition of a one-man show entitled Kent Ulberg, A Retrospective, which premiered at the Joslin Art Museum in Omaha. And I say all of that, Josh, because the more you can build up your portfolio through exhibitions and gain exposure, particularly to people who are in positions of power to make acquisitions at museums and give you exhibitions and influence collectors, that all becomes part of your arsenal to help promote your work and to gain acceptance and create awareness of your work throughout the larger society.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Josh, for calling. I appreciate your call. And just to go back to Ken for a minute, you also actually probably were the first, if I'm not mistaken, to use stainless steel in your work.
Yes, that's correct. And I must say that I am so fortunate to, A, have come to the U.S., and you know, which give me the opportunities to engage in my habit, you know, in and which I would do even if it was illegal, you know, I would sculpt, and now I can make a living with it, and that's the U.S. But even more so, I happened by chance to end up, but first of all, the Denver Museum of Natural History, I was the curator for the African Hall. They came to Botswana, and where I was the curator for the National Museum in Botswana, and I was their host, and then they invited me to Denver, and I ended up working in the Denver area. It's a long story around, but north of Denver is a little town called Loveland, and there was a foundry with the most incredible technology, basically a metallurgical engineer who had retired from industry and decided to do a little foundry to do basically mechanical castings and stuff. But with that knowledge that he brought from industry, he could pour any metal you wanted. And I got commissioned to do a sculpture for a very modern building in Dallas in 1979. And the architects, they did not want a bronze. In fact, they didn't want realism at all because it was the international style. You know, that Dallas look, if you remember the Dallas TV series, it always started with those stainless steel buildings, you know?
Yeah.
And so I asked Bob Zimmerman, who's the name of the foundry man, if we could attempt to cast something in stainless steel, and we did. And that was the first cast stainless steel monumental sculpture, I believe. And it has technical difficulties, you know, because we pour bronze around 1,800 degrees or so, and stainless steel at 3,200. And you can't normally melt it with a traditional way with gas furnace in the foundries. You know, you need a higher technology than that. So I am doubly grateful to have ended up where I did, you know.
Well, and that's in a photo of that, and the story of that is in your book, too, isn't it, David?
It is. It's a great story, and it really launches Kent's career into all sorts of other directions. He has a beautiful stainless steel sculpture in front of the National Wildlife Federation in Washington, D.C., of cranes. And another thing that I love about Kent's work is that it's rich in so many different ways. The title, for example, of the cranes is allegorical in a reference to a ballet, and if you look at the way Kent took Lincoln Center Eagle in Dallas and he positioned it to the people driving by on the freeway, they don't see the front of the bird, they see the back, and the bird looking at the building itself, and that draws them in and creates sort of a perspective that's interesting. And he layers up his sculptures with a lot of thought. And I think in my career, a lot of his ideas, before I really focused in more deeply, they just flew right by me, and I was really unaware of them. But as I studied it more and more, I just became more appreciative of the depth of his thinking. He's some of the great artists throughout time and of our time, like Ulberger, Robert Bateman, for example, have that ability to really keep bringing you back and learning more and more and more through their sculpture. And Ulberg certainly has that ability.
We have an email from Robin, and she says, "I commend any artist who focuses on nature and appreciate the comment on non-objective art. I've traveled the world and have been to plenty of art museums. I was amazed at the different reactions to my reactions to works of natural art, which seems to be reverent, in comparison to that of modern art, or as I like to call it, confusion art, especially sculpture. The art of nature is, in my opinion, the highest art form, and to try to replicate it through paint or clay or other is respectable for the both technical precision and philosophical spiritual effect that it gives. My problem as an aspiring artist, Robin says, is accuracy and patience. Most of my nature art looks like cartoons. How much time do most artists or nature artists spend perfecting their skills?" And you know, Kent, you might say that's a lifelong thing, but comment?
Yeah, well, you know, there are two different things here. One is skill, you know, which is actually comes just from working at it. You know, you get better and better. But there is something also unique about nature artists, and we just touched upon a little bit, and that is the knowledge that you have to have. You know, you have to have knowledge of anatomy. You have to have knowledge, if you're painting, of their habitat, their personality. And I can only speak for myself, but I think it's vitally important to work from direct experience. In other words, experience in nature, preferably, with your subjects. Of course, there is something that translates, where there is something that happens when you see something in nature, see the real thing. It's very hard to touch upon. But in Hemingway, for example, I think he said it very, very beautifully. You know, he said, if you write what you know, what you've seen, what you've experienced, it becomes the truth, and it maybe becomes art. And I think in wildlife art is more important than anywhere else. You know, rather than working from a photograph, go out there and look, and go out there and experience it, and it'll speak to you. And also, when you then speak through your artist, through your art to your public, they feel some of that. I think that you captured some of that truth, something you felt that you're translating. You know, so there's a long answer, but I think it's vitally important. Most great wildlife artists spend a tremendous amount of time with their subject matter.
You know, it's kind of to go along with that. You have a quite a concern and interest in the environment. How is that embodied in your sculptures?
I have basically dedicated my life and work to speak about my deep love for nature and the environment. And you know, doing public sculptures, doing large monuments, of course, it gives you a bigger voice. Though very seldom do I, you know, get sort of reactionary, like sculpting, like Bateman does, for example. You know, he shows drift nets with dead birds and stuff in it. I do that very seldom. I have done a sculpture that is in Dave's book called Requiem for Prince William Sound, which shows a dying eagle with a head cast back and direct reaction to the great oil disaster, you know, in Prince William Sound. But normally I try to do it through showing my love, showing the beauty, ask people to look through my eyes and see how much I admire this thing, how beautiful it is. And also, of course, I'm also active. I donate a lot of my work to nature conservation groups that are being auctioned off. And I'm one of the founders of the Gulf Coast Conservation Association, which has become a nationwide now, coastal conservation. And so I'm active in that field as well.
And you have a new sculpture in Omaha, Dave was mentioning to me earlier, that is has to be, and maybe Dave, you can talk about it. It has to almost be seen to be believed.
Well, I haven't seen the finished product. In fact, I'm not sure Kent if it even is finished yet. He's been working on bison and geese and to inhabit a major intersection on Route 66 in downtown Omaha and revitalize the city thanks to the sponsorship of, I think it's First National Bank there. And this sculpture is a real Baroque kind of thing where geese are attached to buildings. They're coming in atriums of banks. One half of the geese might be of a goose might be stainless. The other half might be bronze. It's a real tour de force. And Kent, where are you with that? And what more has come of it since I've seen it maybe about 2 years ago, actually?
Since then, Dave, I've done a bison going through a corner of a building, just like the geese do. Yeah. And basically, you know, the marvelous thing is here, and what's unique about this thing, like Dave said too, is I've basically been given 6 blocks of downtown Omaha as a canvas to work on, you know. I have sculptures attached to traffic lights, to buildings, to street lights, to hanging in atriums, going through, and like I said, bison running in city planters, and I call it the spirit of wilderness. And again, this is sort of an environmental statement. You know, the bison ran here first And then people put up buildings, you know, but the spirit of wilderness don't respect buildings. They go as the buildings weren't there. And it's a wonderful opportunity, and I've worked on it now for 8 years, and I'm almost done. I have one more bison to do, and then the work is completed. It'll be 9 years of work, but it's been the most satisfying. And, you know, people really, they love it. They interact with them. The kids, they are perfectly welcome to ride on the geese that are on the side in the park. And the other day I was there, there's a bison calf on the sidewalk, and there were two businessmen had a conference, and they had their laptops on top of the bison's back. You know, right? And I mean, I love it. You know, that's to me, it's what sculpture is about, you know, the interaction with the public, you know.
One thing that wasn't mentioned earlier also is the scale of your work. I think you must certainly do the largest bronze installations in this day and age, maybe of all time. And after Mount Rushmore, even, I can't think of sculptures that are much larger than yours. The sailfish in Three Stages of Ascending in Fort Lauderdale must have weighed, what, tons and tons. So these are huge, huge, huge projects that take years and years to create.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dave. Yeah, you're right. It was about 5 tons of the main element there in Fort Lauderdale. It's 36 foot high bronze.
Oh,
and but you know, in total mass, in bronze mass, the Omaha's got it beat. You know, because it's 58 geese, larger than life, 8 foot wingspan, and 9 bison. You know, bigger than life, and. So in tonnage, it's quite a bit. I just hope they're not going to melt them down and make shell casings from them, you know?
Well,
you know that faith, you know that, Larry, that faith has happened to a lot of wonderful art during the wars, you know, in Germany and elsewhere. And, you know, the most incredible thing is Michelangelo's, the only bronze he ever did, was of the Pope Julius II for the city of Bologna, And then the city got mad at him, and he had a war with the city, and they melted down the bronze and made a cannon and shot at the Pope with it. So, you know, you never know.
Wow. Well, some of those photos in David's book, American Wildlife Art, there are some beautiful photos from the Omaha exhibit, and it's absolutely fantastic. And, David, I know you're going to be doing some book signings and some lectures, and maybe you could tell us about what's coming up for you.
Well, this weekend I'm going to be actually flying out to open an exhibition with Robert Bateman in San Diego, where I'm speaking with Bob Monday evening. But closer to home in Madison, a week from tomorrow on November 20th, I'll be speaking at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum under the Friends of the Arboretum Luncheon Lecture Series at 11:45 to 1:30. I'm told there's a great number of people that have already signed up for that luncheon, and I hope many more will come. I'll have books there and be happy to answer any questions after my slide presentation and sign books after that.
And you'll be in Milwaukee as well.
I'll be speaking at the Urban Ecology Center, not far from UWM, at 1500 East Park Place in Milwaukee, on December 7th, and we'll be doing a lecture at 3 p.m. followed by a book signing.
And just to go back to the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, you do need to have advanced registration. If you just go to the UW-Madison Arboretum website, you can probably find that information. But you could also call, and if you want to call, the phone number is area 608-263-7760, 263-7760, and be able to attend that. I tell you what, thank you both. David, Ken, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It was a great honor.
Ken Albrecht is the number one living wildlife sculptor in the world, and a lot of his work is featured in David Wagner's 424-page volume book titled American Wildlife Art. It's a wonderful book, and I hope you have a chance to get a look at it. Not only sculptor, but all types of wildlife art represented in that book. And thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.